We begin today's 2 hours of Issues Etc. with a religion roundup and a bit of reflection on the part of our guest in the first half hour, Uwe Simonetto, on the 40th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. That's coming up Saturday, that anniversary. And of course, if you've been watching television, all you have to do is flip around the channels once or twice and you will run across a retrospective or a documentary about the assassination or the Kennedy years. It's out there all over the place. We'll get Uwe Simonetto's reaction up front as we begin a religion roundup with him in just a few minutes here on Issues Etc. Starting at 3:30 or so, we're going to have open lines for your questions and your comments. We've got some audio, various reactions to the Supreme Court decision in Massachusetts that came down yesterday regarding gay marriage. We'll hear from both sides of that issue, and we'll take your questions and your comments, your reaction to the Supreme Court decision in Massachusetts that says gay marriage cannot be banned according to the Massachusetts state constitution. That's the second part of Issues Etc. From 4:30 to 5, we're going to be talking with the co-authors of this series in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on Joyce Meyer, Joyce Meyer Ministries, A Special Report. Now, we're going to be not only talking about what is in the newspaper today, but the previous parts of the series as well with its co-authors, and we'll spend some time at the end of that conversation so that they can describe the reaction they've been getting from the public on this series on Joyce Meyer Ministries. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I give you those numbers because in the third hour, we're devoting it entirely to your thoughts, your comments, and your reactions to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch series on Joyce Meyer. We want to hear from you starting at 5 o'clock here on Issues Etc. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest with us. He comes alongside almost every week now for a religion roundup. He's religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from France this afternoon. Uwe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Nice to be back.
Uwe, your reflections and reactions at the 40th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy?
Well, you see, this was one of my first really hot topics that I covered as a young reporter or a young foreign correspondent. I just arrived a little less a year earlier in the United States as a correspondent for the Springer for a News Service of Germany. And that particular Friday was my day off, and I was at home and had the television on, and suddenly, you know, Walter Cronkite appeared and told me that Kennedy had been murdered. From then on, of course, I got dressed, rushed out, went around Harlem because I thought, you know, the office was covering the running story, so I better do some sidebar stuff. Went into several of those black churches, which was very moving because that was, of course, also at the height of the civil rights movement, and Kennedy was their hero. And then I went back, wrote the story. And nobody could, including one of our editors-in-chief in Germany, could believe this should have been just one man who might have done that. And that was the time when Germany was getting rich, the economic miracle. So one of my editors-in-chief said, well, why don't you just pack your suitcase full of $100 notes and take $100,000, fly down to Dallas and find the real killer. We sort of laughed about that, but I did go down to Dallas. It was a very strange thing because most of the European journalists who went to Dallas and hung around the Dallas Morning News at the time couldn't quite grasp that this might have been just this woman. We all thought it was a conspiracy. But it turned out not so much as a conspiracy. It actually was a very rather unique story, and we can discuss this in detail, but it actually can take hours to do so. You know?
It certainly would. As far as you're concerned, Uwe, purely from a journalistic standpoint, do you think the entire story of the Kennedy assassination has been told and the details as we know them are completely accurate, with one shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald, wielding one gun and killing the president that day in November in 1963?
Well, I did study the Warren Report very carefully, and of course I did a lot of research in those days. I still, has the full story been told? It's possible, this is simply speculation because there's not enough evidence for that. It is possible that somebody compelled Oswald to do so. Oswald was a communist. He had links to Cuba. Both Castro and Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union had caused us to be very angry with Kennedy because he stared them down in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, of course, had this come out at the time, if there had been any evidence for a Soviet or Cuban involvement, it would have been very, very unwise for the federal government to announce this because that would have led to war and, of course, nuclear war. But, again, this is speculation. I have no evidence. I simply know that, we will never find out in my lifetime whatever the government might have discovered. It certainly wouldn't come out now. Maybe in another generation or two, we will find out that the Soviets or the Cubans might have been involved. But I don't know. I would not speculate on that.
Finally, on that subject, Uwe, your reflections on John F. Kennedy as a man and a president.
Well, we know very little about him. He was a president in that he stimulated thought. He actually he was a very dynamic character. He had been a president for less than 3 years. So we don't really know very much how good a president or how bad a president he was. I know he failed in many ways in, for example, the previous big story I'd covered. In fact, the last story I ever covered in Germany was the construction of the Berlin Wall, where I suspect that he had not been a particularly great president because he had not reacted forcefully. At the time, in 1961, when I was stationed in Berlin, we had enough information that the Soviet Union had tried Kennedy and egged him on, and clearly he had not reacted to it, and so therefore we've had this very, very long period of a divided Europe. Perhaps at the time had Kennedy been a little more experienced, there would not have been this division of Europe, or the division of Europe would have ended in 1961. We don't know. As a man, of course, he was a very complex character, but then who wasn't? And I found him to be a very exciting president.
Yesterday, the Massachusetts Supreme Court here in the United States ruled that gay marriage could not be banned under Massachusetts state law or under the constitution of that state. This comes out precisely at the same time that a new Pew survey on American religious moral attitudes comes out. What does the survey tell us?
Well, the survey tells us that that an increasing number, 59% of the Americans, which is 6% more than in the summer, just consider homosexual marriage as wrong, period. And it also shows us that the acceptance of the homosexual lifestyle by the American public is decreasing rather than increasing, which is a there's another aspect, of course, to it that the Americans say, well, obviously there shouldn't be a discrimination of homosexuals, and so therefore the tolerance level is increasing, but in reality the acceptance is decreasing, and the Pew survey tells us that there is evidently something of a backlash going on. People are simply getting sick and tired of having this rammed down our throats.
This comes at the same time that the average person can hardly not have noticed that in popular culture, the homosexual lifestyle is being portrayed as glamorous, as carefree and virtuous, as a mere alternative to any other kind of lifestyle,
right.
And in popular sitcoms as kind of the source of one of the richest sources of humor. Some of the funniest characters on American sitcoms are the gay characters in those programs.
Yeah, and in the Pew study, it just shows that Americans are not do not agree with this. They think there's too much of this. They think it is just simply wrong, and they wish it wouldn't be like that. Which is quite interesting, because this is the voice of the people. When you then go deeper into that study, you'll find that college graduates and big city guy types, well, they think it's all wonderful, but the average American doesn't agree with it.
What role does religion play in Americans' responses to questions like this?
Well, the more religious they are, the more opposed they are to this. Interestingly enough, you have two sets of people, or three sets of people. First of all, of course, you have your run-of-the-mill American Protestant, mainline Protestant, or Roman Catholic. They are opposed to it, but less so than evangelicals. Evangelicals are very opposed to it. And then, of course, you have the minority of strictly secular Americans who affirm at a rate of 6 to 1 or something like that the homosexual lifestyle. Basically, all believing Americans, especially all Christian Americans, are actually opposed to it, and that is very interesting. So this is being rammed down our throats, and Americans aren't going for it.
Also, at the beginning of this month, the Episcopal Church USA, the oldest denomination in the United States, if not the largest, consecrated its first openly gay bishop.
Right.
Much to the chagrin of worldwide Anglicanism. What do you think the Episcopal Church USA should take from this latest survey of the public attitudes toward the gay lifestyle and gay marriage?
Well, if they were still a church, they should go back to their sources, and to the sources, of course, of the church are Scripture, source of Scripture. But they will not do so. They will continue along the previous lines, which have caused them to lose one third of their membership in the last 30 years. And it's going to get worse. On the other hand, of course, there will be another Anglican denomination. There are lots of smaller ones anyway already, but others that will be in communion with the world Anglican communion. You notice that several African churches have already severed relations with the Episcopal Church.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International, and he joins us this afternoon for our Religion Roundup from France. Uwe, George Barna also has done some research, as he usually does, having to do with religious formation early in life. Tell us what Barna has discovered.
Well, Barna has discovered that actually religious maturity, in every sense of the word, is achieved in early childhood before you turn into a teenager. In other words, once you're a teenager, your faith and your moral perceptions, your moral convictions are all in place. Which I find fascinating, because Barna Obama's research in the year 2003 proves that the Jews and the Christians throughout the history of the church have always been right. That once you turn 13, 14, you're being bar mitzvahed or confirmed, and then you become a mature Christian and you know what's right and what's wrong. Without any prodding, Barna discovered the same thing.
And what are the details here? Give us a few details of what it is Barna discovered about religious formation, value formation early in life.
Well, details are, for example, that, you know, when by the time you're nine, your moral values are in place. Before you turn 10, 11, 12, you are either committed or not committed to Christ as your Lord and Savior. You may later on refine your faith, but by and large, this is once that is hammered in, you're fine. The other detail that he discovered is, of course, that if you've been brought up a Christian, if you've been brought up in a congregation, and if the congregation ministered to you, the chances are greater that you yourself will become a church worker, will become a pastor, or whatever. So in the formative years are indeed, as the Jesuits have always been saying, the Jesuits said, give me the first 7 years, well, maybe a little longer, maybe nine, but the formative years are those young years. And what is so pathetic in our age is, of course, when parents say, well, we'll leave this to later, you decide whether you want to be a Christian or not, and of course, you know, what they create is a spiritual blubber rather than mature human beings. The fact is that as the church and then Judaism have always known, you become a Christian, you become a believer when you're young. And it depends on your parents, and it depends on your spiritual leaders, like the pastors, etc.
You have a story to tell. It's not a unique story, but it is one that is compelling, especially for us Americans, from your childhood and your religious formation. Yes. Tell us about that.
Well, it's an incredible story. On December, I'm from Leipzig in Germany, which is, of course, the city of Johann Sebastian Bach. I was brought up there, and my father was blind. He was a prosecutor in charge of juvenile delinquency in Leipzig and the delinquency department. And we were living in the center of town, and of course on the 4th of December 1943, we were bombed out. And my father, when the alarm was sounded, my father and my mother and I were sitting in the air raid shelter, and my father, having lost his eyesight in the First World War and the hearing in one ear, had a particularly strong hearing in the other ear, in the right ear, and he had this ear pinned to the wall and said, you know, there's something flowing down outside this wall, and it must be phosphor. So everybody out of the cellar. So we all went out, rushed out, and of course, the whole city was burning, and not only that, the streets were burning. There were sort of puddles of green flames, and that was phosphor burning. My mother then said to me, you put a coat on my back and said, you take your father to grandmother, and then she proceeded to extinguish the flames, which she never succeeded in doing. So my father and I walked through this burning city with burning people coming out of burning houses, and we sort of hopped about in between those burning puddles of phosphor. I described the scene to my father, and then experienced something that only later, because I later had been in Vietnam and had dealt with Vietnam veterans, the data that I discovered were, of course, flashbacks. As I described this horror, my father my father holding my upper arm twitched, and his hands twitched and grabbed me like that. Of course, he was experiencing all the horrors of World War I again. Anyway, we then arrived at my grandmother's home, and she was a wonderful woman. Immediately, she saw us coming, she immediately started grating potatoes to make potato pancakes. You know, you see, she was a Saxon woman, and that's what Saxon grannies do. They make potato pancakes for you. And in the afternoon, suddenly, five Frenchmen showed up, carrying my mother. My mother, by that time, was blind, too, although that not forever. She regained her life, but she had been... she had been extinguishing flames, and they must have been friends of my nanny. I used to have a French nanny, whom we had sent back to France. And these were deportees; these were indentured laborers who had crashed through the flames and gone into our burning house. And found my mother there and said, "Madame, it's time for you to go." And my mother was still trying to throw stuff out the windows. And my mother, being the quintessential Saxon, you know, we Saxons are called coffee Saxons. She said, "But before we go, this is, you know, here's this house burning and everything's burning around us. She makes coffee, and since there was no water there." She still had some bottled seltzer, some seltzer water, and she had an immersion heater. There was still electricity in the house. And these French people later told me, here's this young, my mother was 27, this young German woman who was a singer, in the middle of all these flames making coffee for us. And so we sat down and we had a cup of coffee in her mice and china, which all disappeared, of course, in the flames afterwards. And then we had was her Bible. This was our family Bible, beautiful 17th century Bible. And my mother lost her consciousness, and they grabbed her and put the Bible on her belly and carried her out of those flames, and clear through Leipzig, to my grandmother's place, and dumped her in front of us. And, you know, and then eventually my mother regained her eyesight and told us further details of this story. My recollection of this is, of course, it was at that moment that for me in 1943 the Franco-German friendship commenced, at a time when we considered each other arch enemies. But of course, you know, these five Frenchmen risked their lives for an enemy, for a young woman, a German woman, yanking her out of the flames and bringing her to me.
Uwe, I want to take a break here, and when we come back, I'd like to keep you for a few minutes, allow you to finish your story and make the connection for us and our listeners with those early experiences, harrowing as they are, and your religious formation. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. He's joining us this afternoon from France for our religion roundup. When we come back, the rest of Uwe's story, and we'll talk about one more person here, Sergei Anatolievich Torop. Who is he? What is he up to? We'll find out when we come back. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we conclude our conversation with Uwe, we'll have open lines for your questions and your comments.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, on why he's a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I joined the Missouri Synod for three reasons. First, as a journalist, I live in quicksand. Thus, I need a rock-solid church that preaches God's work faithfully and intelligently. Second, in my work, one is hostage to the fads that violate God's will. The Missouri Synod does not prostitute itself to these fads. Third, my business is short-lived news. Therefore, I hunger for the eternal news that God's care spans all history. That's what this Lutheran church teaches.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on an outreach in Switzerland that started with roses. Two women missionaries with Operation Mobilization walked along the streets of Zurich offering roses to prostitutes and telling them about Christ's love. They also went inside the nightclubs and asked permission to speak with women there. To their surprise, several women told the women missionaries how much they appreciated the thoughtfulness. There's also a need to reach women in other cities. In Bern, Switzerland, there are over 700 Thai women who are prostitutes. Pray for missionaries with Operation Mobilization to continue finding creative ways to share Christ in Switzerland and throughout Europe. Pray that they'll be effective in proclaiming Christ's love to people who will never normally go to a church building. Get prayer updates and see how you can go as a missionary. Log on to the website www.usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Yesterday's papers reported AARP will use its considerable influence to urge passage of a Medicare bill that's been agreed upon by a House and Senate Conference Committee. That bill is intended to help seniors and the disabled deal with medical costs. God didn't create mankind with health problems, but as in so many other areas of life, sin has disrupted the Creator's kindly plan. So we have to go to the doctor and pop our pills. Go to the doctor and pop our pills, trusting God's promise the Lord will sustain him on his sickbed and restore him from his bed of illness. Psalm 41:3. We go to the doctor and pop our pills, confident of the better future Christ has won for us. St. Paul says, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. 2 Corinthians 4:16-18. And we are comforted by the love of others. St. John says, Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers.
Here's a couple of concert opportunities for you this Advent. The Concordia Seminary Chorus Advent Tour includes a performance Sunday, December 7th at 7 p.m. at the Chapel of St. Timothy and St. Titus on the campus of Concordia Seminary. Then Wednesday, December 10th at 7 p.m. at Timothy Lutheran Church in Southwest St. Louis. The Concordia Seminary Chorus in concert. To learn more about the Advent Tour, call Concordia Seminary.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Halfway through this first hour of the program, we're going to keep Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, around for a few more minutes to conclude our religion roundup with him. Then we have open lines for your questions and your comments. During open lines, we're going to hear the reaction from those, a few of those, who brought suit in Massachusetts and eventually rendered the decision yesterday in the Massachusetts Supreme Court that a ban on gay marriage in that state would be unconstitutional according to their state constitution. We'll hear from both sides on that, and I'd like your reaction as well to that decision. The decision is nuanced, and when we get to that hour of open lines, I want to explain, I've been listening a little bit to reaction to it in the media, and I think it's being misrepresented, and in interest of the truth, we need to be clear about what the Supreme Court in Massachusetts did and did not say in that decision yesterday. We'll be talking about it during open lines in just a few minutes. Uwe, you were telling us a story from your childhood when we went to the break. I'd like you to conclude your story and then tell us a bit about your own personal experience with that, with religious formation early in life.
Yes, well, that's, that is quite interesting. Well, as I said, we then, of course, had to move into my grandmother's place, which was not bombed out, although in a subsequent air raid in February of 1944, virtually all the other buildings around us were destroyed by blockbusters, and most of my classmates died in those air raids. But it was during those air raids that my wonderful, wonderful grandmother actually taught me what it was to be a Christian. She always dressed up in her Sunday best, when the first alarm was sounded, because she said she might meet her maker that way, and so therefore she wanted to be prepared. It was a symbol. It wasn't, I mean, she wasn't superstitious or anything. It was a symbol to the rest of us, a sign what we were supposed to be like. So she went downstairs, and then she sat erectly with her lorgnette and her hair all stuck up and a choker around her throat and her neck, and holding me in her arms and singing hymns all through those air raids. Now, you must imagine, we're sitting here, we are in a sort of big city block of apartments, in the downstairs among the potatoes and the coals, and the walls crack open, and fire comes in, and smoke comes in, and the walls shake. And at one point, actually, a blockbuster came all the way from the roof right down and got stuck in our vault, in the vaulted ceiling. And we looked up. It was a dud, thank God. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. And she just sang and prayed and chided the Nazi party officers who came in from the street and who were shivering and shaking, said, this was your war. We didn't want this war. We don't want any war. You wanted this. Now, at least pull yourselves together and don't set a bad example to my grandson. You know, later on in life, when I later was a correspondent for 5 years in the Vietnam War, I always remembered these wonderful Lutheran hymns that my grandmother sang. They were in my ear, and they accompanied me. Well, they've accompanied me to this very day. So to me, you see, World War II, the air war, all these things had a very beneficial effect, because they taught me to be a Christian.
Uwe, finally, who is Sergei Anatolievich Torop?
Well, he's a former Siberian traffic cop who set himself up as a reincarnation of Jesus Christ. He looks like him. He dresses like a Russian icon depicting Christ. And he has started a sect in the middle of Siberia, some 2,500 miles east of Moscow. And thousands are coming from all over the world, all primarily former atheists, intellectuals mainly, who actually believe that he is the Christ. And so they give up everything, and they give up all their money, sell their... But they're coming from Germany, they're coming from America, they're coming from Australia, and they venerate this guy who sits on a mountaintop, quite removed from them. There's a bell that rings, thunders down, and in the valley they all assemble three times a day and pray to him. And there is a fear, of course, that that he may turn out to be a Russian sort of Jim Jones, if you recall that event when they all killed themselves in Guyana. And there is a reason for people to fear that he might actually induce his followers to commit mass suicide, because he keeps saying, well, suicide in the end is not such a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's a good thing, so you should be able to decide what to do. And anyway, you have 10 lives, and in those 10 lives, of course, you have to grow spiritually. If not, you wind up in hell, which, of course, is... quite different from the message of the real Jesus Christ.
So, in essence, this is more or less, as you have observed, simply a New Age message of this Torah.
It is a New Age message, of course, resembling many of the false Christs that have come before him. Yes, it's a New Age message. It's syncretistic. It's a mixing of religion with reincarnation, all that sort of thing, and it has a peculiar appeal to people who have. But that goes back to our first thing, you know, the Barna story, being brought up as Christians in your childhood. People who have not been brought up as Christians in childhood, the problem is never. People who don't believe anything, it's the problem is always that people will believe anything unless they have been properly raised in the faith.
Uwe, thank you very much for being our guest again
thank
on
you.
Issues, Etc. Thanks for staying those extra few minutes with us.
Okay, thanks.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International, and he joined us from France for our religion roundup. Now, as we reported yesterday on Issues, Etc., the Massachusetts Supreme Court has declared a ban on gay marriage unconstitutional according to the Massachusetts state constitution. I've been listening intently to the media coverage of this particular decision on the part of the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, and what I've heard is, I guess you could call it an oversimplification or just downright misinformation about this. We tried to sort this out as we talked yesterday with a guest from the Family Research Council, and I want to do it one more time before we launch into some of the reaction that I'd like you to hear, and then get your reaction as well, because we begin open lines at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The Massachusetts Supreme Court did not say that Massachusetts ought to have gay marriage. They did not say that. You might infer that from their decision. It's sad to say that one of the first things they cited in their 40-plus page decision was the Lawrence v. Texas Supreme Court decision of recent memory. Do you remember this? The sodomy law down in Texas was overturned. That's one of the first precedents they cite. But they did not say that the state of Massachusetts should have gay marriage. They did not say that gay marriage is legal. They did not say that the legislature should pass a legalization or a recognition of gay marriage. They simply said, if you're going to ban gay marriage, you can't do it under our Constitution. Then they did something that I think may be a hopeful sign in Massachusetts for two reasons. But what they did was they said the Massachusetts state legislature has about 6 months to do something about this. There are two possibilities. One is bad, one is good. The legislature could say, all right, let's just recognize same-sex marriage. Like Vermont, they could do that. Or the legislature in those 6 months could do what Mitt Romney, the governor of Massachusetts, has said he's already willing to help them do. And that is amend the state constitution to define marriage as only a man and only a woman. Now, do you see the nuance here? What the Supreme Court of Massachusetts has said is, as the constitution is written now, we can't ban gay marriage. If you want to amend it and amend language into the Constitution that would define marriage as a man and a woman, well, then we can ban gay marriage. See, I think this is a more hopeful story than it is being popularly portrayed in the press. Will the Massachusetts state legislature do that? I don't know. Part of me says, don't count on it. Part of me says, look, if the Supreme Court in your state gives you an opportunity, hey, you have 6 months to amend the Constitution. Well, you know, it's going to actually take more than 6 months. The first time such an amendment could actually enter the Constitution, given the way that they do it there in Massachusetts, is about 2005. But 6 months is a good start, right? So they did not say that Massachusetts should have or does have gay marriage. That is still a question mark. Now, let's get some reaction from those individuals, just a few of them, who were involved in this court case. First, we hear from the Reverend Richard Richardson of the Black Ministerial Alliance. He says gay marriage poorly serves children.
We feel that the marriage between a man and a woman is essential to keeping the family intact and to be able to be sure that children are raised in an appropriate manner, that they will be able to know not only a mother, but a father also.
Now, this is a good, solid sociological objection, don't you think? Look, if we care about the children, then gay marriage probably isn't a good idea. Probably isn't a good idea. Now, let's hear from some folks on the other side of the issue. The Reverend William Sinkford, president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, which filed a brief in support of gay couples, those who brought this case to the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Well, Sinkford says that his organization has been fighting for gay marriage for a very long time.
I could not be happier. We are enthusiastically in support of the decision by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in favor of same-sex marriage. Unitarian Universalism has a long-standing and deeply held religious commitment to support full equality for bisexual, gay, lesbian, and transgender people. And today's ruling is a significant step forward in guaranteeing that right.
it may or it may not be a significant step forward. What I found intriguing by in Sinkford's comments there in support of gay marriage is it's not just gay marriage. He says the Universalist Unitarian Association has been a longtime supporter of rights for gay, lesbian, and transgendered. And, of course, if you know anything about the gay activist movement, that list goes on. There are, at least according to some activist groups, seven genders or more. And if you consider it discrimination not to allow same-gendered couples to marry, then you would probably, if you add seven genders, consider it discrimination. Oh, and one of those genders might possibly be man-boy love. Just think about that. If one of your genders, if you could say, well, my gender is, I'm essentially a pedophile. That's my gender. I'm not speaking it in terms of a criminal act. I'm speaking in terms of where my sexual orientation lies. I'm a pedophile. I like the kids. You know, Michael Jackson could say at this point, all I'm doing is acting on my gender if the charges against him in the latest case are true. This is my gender. Well, if we cannot ban gay marriage, then what would stop us from, what would stop the pedophile from saying, you also can't ban the kind of marriage I like. If I want to marry a boy or a little girl or something like that. You see, we always have to be able to play out whatever is being said here. We have to, the devil is always, always in the details. In addition, Pastor Sinkford of the Unitarian Universalist Association says that he knows the couples who brought the case in this Massachusetts Supreme Court case.
These are wonderful folks. In fact, they are my friends. They are all in longstanding, deeply committed relationships, partnerships. And it is my hope that all 14 of them are celebrating.
All right. We've heard this before, haven't we? Longstanding, deeply committed relationships. It's becoming boilerplate rhetoric. Longstanding, deeply committed. That now seems to be the only qualification for marriage. Marriage no longer is a man and a woman, at least according to the Reverend Sinkford. Marriage is any relationship that is longstanding and deeply committed. Now, I'm trying to think of the relationships in my life that are longstanding and deeply committed. You know what? I have a longstanding and deeply committed relationship with my producer. We're both heterosexual men with wives. Don't get me wrong. But we've been friends and work colleagues for 5 years now, and a strong commitment to the mutual goals that we share for this program. We even occasionally manage to get along. Now, who's to stop me from saying, look, I've got a longstanding, deeply committed relationship here? Or, for that matter, with my dog. Our sweet little dog. She's 7 going on 8. And in dog years, that's a longstanding relationship. She is well past middle age. There's never been a more devoted pet I've ever had. She is deeply committed to me. Now, it may have only to do with the fact that I pay for the dog food, but look, that's what dogs do. And, of course, I'm committed to her. I make sure she's fed. And when my daughter makes sure that I'm reminded, walked and things like that. There's a longstanding, deeply committed relationship. Maybe you could even call it a marriage. What do you think? It's open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Finally, let's hear from Gloria Bailey. She is one of the plaintiffs in the gay marriage lawsuit. She says that she and her partner now have security for their relationship.
This is the happiest day in our lives. And the most important thing for us is knowing whatever comes ahead in the rest of our lives, we now know we can be at each other's side.
Okay, that's Gloria Bailey, one of the ladies in a lesbian couple. The issue that was at the heart of this case, if you look into it, was actually hospital visitation rights. That's what they were asking for. Husbands and wives enjoy in the state of Massachusetts certain benefits and privileges regarding hospital visitation. And they were bringing their case saying, we would like to know that if in the future we're ever hospitalized, one of us or the other of us, that we would have the same kind of privileges as a lesbian couple, as a husband and wife would. That was the genesis of this. That's why she says, we know that whatever comes in our life, we will be able to be there for one another. I'd like your reaction to this. You've had a couple days to kind of think this over and mull it over. What do you think of this? Is this a step forward, or has the Massachusetts Supreme Court actually left the door open to an amendment to the Massachusetts Constitution? Mitt Romney says, hey, that would be a good idea, and he's the governor. And given the fact that we have public polls from the Pew organization that's out yesterday saying, look, as a whole, the American public is generally unfavorable toward gay marriage. If the tide is turning, which way do you think it is turning in this case? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. for about the next 35 minutes. And when we reach the 4:30 hour, we're going to be talking with Carolyn Tuft and Bill Smith. They are, of course, the co-authors of a series in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, four installments. The fourth was out today. Joyce Meyer Ministries, a special report. We'll also spend the 45 minutes remaining after that conversation in open lines with you, getting your reaction to the investigative report of Joyce Meyer. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I know that when you hear Massachusetts Supreme Court says you can't ban gay marriage, it sounds like bad news. But if we read, not between the lines, but deeper into the story, it might be an opportunity. Let's see what Keith thinks. He's calling from his car. Keith, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. Simple question. Why would anyone not want the couple that wants to have the right to visit each other as though they were married, why would anyone that claims to be a Christian not want them to have that right?
I don't know that anybody does want to refuse them that right, and I think you're right in pointing it out, Keith. I think
if it's at the heart of the matter, and you said that it was, I mean, if that was what their case is based on, how could anyone object to that?
All right, Keith, thank you very much. Well, personally, I don't object to anyone having visitation rights in the hospital. That's fine. I said it was the genesis. It's not the heart of the matter. It was the genesis of the case. It was the beginning of the case. But, of course, the case became about gay marriage, about not only hospital visitation rights, but all of the rights and privileges that accrue to married couples under the Massachusetts State Constitution being afforded. And we're not just talking about the right to visit one another in the hospital or something like that. You're right. No one would want to deny that to anyone, and I don't think that was really the issue. The issue is, well, if you grant us this one thing, this simple one thing, that who could argue with it, how could you not grant us all of the other rights, privileges, and legal recognition that go along with being husband and wife? Even though we're not husband and wife, we're wife and wife. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For heaven's sakes, if lesbian couples want to visit each other in the hospital, they certainly should be able to. The question is, should they be able to do it recognized by the state as married? Or should we just simply say, look, people ought to be able to visit one another in the hospital? Now, I don't know why a Christian would want to deny that. I do know why Christians would want to deny legal recognition to same-sex couples. Number one, as we discussed, I think it was yesterday on the program, maybe the day before, the real heart of the issue is, who gets to define marriage? Where did marriage come from is actually a question that needs to be asked even before that one. Where did marriage come from? There are two possibilities. One is, it's a human invention, we made it up, and therefore that answers the second question. If human beings made up the whole concept and institution of marriage, then human beings have every right to redefine it as often and in any way they want to. We made it up. They can change the rules anytime they want to. All right? But what if marriage comes from someplace outside the human experience? What if it comes from a transcendent source rather than a mundane earthly source? What if, as Scripture does teach and Christians do believe, marriage is instituted by God? He thought it up. He invented it. He created it. And speaking in the civil realm, I don't even think you have to appeal to Genesis chapter 1 or 2 to make this argument. I think you can say, look, is marriage something that man invented, or does it have a transcendent source? If it has a transcendent source, then man has no right to redefine it. When I was in high school, we made up a game. It was called Ibli Abens. It was a little game that you roll dice. It didn't make a lot of sense, but it did have a few basic rules. It was a silly little game, Ibli Abens. We made it up, and we used to play it, you know, just to pass the time and act like idiots. Well, the game evolved over time. It started out very simple, and then it got more rules and more rules. My daughter makes up these games with her playground classmates. They start out simple, and then she showed me once, after she came back from a little play session with one of her friends, pages after page of rules for this game that they play. I think they call it trash can tag or something like that. Very serious rules. Now, they can make up those rules and amend those rules and change those rules as often as they want because they made the game up. Is marriage just a game that we made up? If it is, then we can change the rules. If it isn't, then we can't. We can't redefine it or recreate it or reinvent it. Then for the Christian, I think this is even more pertinent, for the Christian, we do know what marriage is. And we know that marriage is, as Paul tells us, really God's lifelong object lesson to his people about Christ and the church. Paul as much says this. When he's talking about husbands and wives, be faithful. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Wives, be subject to your husbands. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then he says at the very end of that little section in Ephesians chapter 5, oh, this is a profound mystery. But what I'm really talking about is Christ and the church. Wow. You mean marriage is ultimately for the Christian about Christ and the church? Paul says, yes, it is. Oh, that's another reason why Christians simply cannot imagine taking marriage between husband and wife and making it something other than it is. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll hear some ex-gays on the other side of the break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.